Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, I hesitated to, like, when I was decided to make this video this morning for my social media, I was like contemplating, do I really want to do this? I'm opening myself up for criticism, but I was like, no, if I feel this way, I've got to go through with this just because I wouldn't be able to look at myself in the mirror. Hey, everybody, I'm Dan McClellan.
And I'm Dan Beecher.
And you're listening to the Data Over Dogma podcast, where we increase public access to the academic study of the Bible and religion and combat the spread of misinformation about the same. How goes the storm, Dan?
Well, it seems to have left you and come to me.
Yes.
We live on opposite sides of the Salt Lake City Valley, and I'm hearing thunder in the background. I hope our listeners can't hear it, but if you can, we'll just call this a moody episode.
Little ambiance, that's all.
Yeah, exactly.
Cuddle up.
I love it. And speaking of moody, we're going to have some fun with a conspiracy. We're doing Conspiracy Watch to start off with. And then we're going to have opportunities for growth. I think that should be a self-help thing. We're going to do Dan's self-help.
And it's going to be me looking into a mirror, right?
Yeah, exactly. You're good enough. You're smart enough. And God doggone it, or God dung it. I'm not sure what I'm trying to say here.
Or you could just go all the way back to Shania Twain. Gone and done it.
Gone and done it. There you go. I like it. Yeah, but no, you are going to be looking into a mirror a little bit because you've revised your position on something.
Yeah, I am capable of growth from time to time. It is painful and it leaves behind a foul-smelling husk, but we have opportunities for growth all the time, and I want to share a little bit about how I don't think my position was necessarily wrong, but I'm going to revise it a little bit because I can point it a little more directly at the target. So we'll get to that at the second half of the show.
I made it sound all sexy and crazy and wild, and then you narrowed it down to the point where it almost doesn't sound like anything happened at all. But that's okay. We're going to have a good time.
Yeah.
Everyone stay tuned to hear how Dan was almost, but not quite, a little bit maybe wrong-ish.
Yeah. Not the first time, and won't be the last time.
But before that, Conspiracy Watch.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, for today's conspiracy, Dan, you suggested this idea, and I tried to Google it. And here's the problem with Googling certain big conspiracies that have been widely and well refuted by respected sources.
Is it all the porn that comes up?
It's all the porn. It's a problem. No, the problem is that what you get is those respected sources and their refutations. Mm-hmm. And their refutations very rarely include like the real off-the-wall dingbat stuff that you're looking for.
There's not a lot of steel manning going on when it comes time to refute some of these asinine conspiracy theories. So when you want the juicy stuff, I want to know exactly what their argument is. From their mouths, yeah. You got to go into the trenches.
And so here's the thing. What we're talking about today is Flat Earth. And what I found, and I think this is why we're talking about it. I don't know. I haven't heard your argument yet, but I believe that this is why we're talking about it. If I type flat earth, I get like page after page after page of refutations of the flat earth conspiracy.
And probably something at the top saying, if you think the earth is flat, here's a number for you to call.
Right. Yeah. Something like that. The flat earth crisis line or whatever. What I found helped was if I typed in the word firmament.
Yes.
Because that changes things a lot and gets us to the heart of one of the main reasons why people are eager to believe that the Earth is flat as opposed to a globe spinning in space.
Okay.
So let's talk a bit about why the flat Earth conspiracy loops back to our subject matter, which is the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to start on that, or do you want me to start?
Okay, yet? I thought you were still leading into.
No, I was leading into you going. Okay, now you say words.
Just to pull the curtain back a little bit, I imagine that sometimes people are like, they must have like a script. They've talked about this stuff beforehand. No, what usually happens is we'll text each other and be like, what do you want to talk about? Oh, I thought of this, I thought of that. And then the other will go and poke around and do some research. And then we get together and we're like, okay, hit record. So anyway, and
yeah. And it's a miracle this makes sense at all.
It's ever. Radio gold, in my opinion. So the Bible and the flat earth, we've got a lot of different ways that the ancient conceptualization of the earth and the universe is represented. But what we don't have is somebody saying, this is what our Earth looks like. What we have are just kind of scattered references to different features of the Earth and the heavens, and we have to kind of piece it all together. And there are two different dimensions to think about this. And we got some $2 words coming up here. One of them is diachronically, and the other is synchronically. Diachronically means through time. And so there are differences as you go from the earlier layers of the Bible to the later layers of the Bible. And then synchronically means at the same time. There can be differences from person to person, place to place at the same time. And so it's not because the Bible's not univocal. I don't know if you've heard about this yet, but
what? What? When did this happen?
It happened on February 3rd. The Bible is no longer univocal. It's multivocal. You have different people saying different things. And so there's a lot of kind of assuming and guesswork and filling in the gaps and trying to construct a cosmology from the Bible. But there are a handful of things that are pretty consistent that we see repeated reference to throughout the Bible. And those things include things like the pillars of the earth. Mm. You get these pillars are referenced all over the place. You get this idea that the earth has been fixed and is immovable. This is something that you find in a number of different places as well.
When you say pillars, are they pillars that are like holding up the sky? Are they pillars that the earth is sitting upon? What pillars are we talking about?
So that it's not entirely clear. We just have a bunch of different references to pillars of the earth. But this is very clearly like foundations, architectural foundations / pillars. So they are things that are supporting, in some sense, the earth.
Okay.
And this is pretty consistent. And it's not just kind of, flowery, poetic stuff. There seems to be this idea that there are foundations and or pillars to the earth. And then we have, you mentioned the firmament. And the firmament comes from the King James translation of a Hebrew word, rakia, which occurs in Genesis 1, where it talks about the heavens, the skies. And the idea in the priestly creation account from Genesis 1, and you can go all the way back to the very first episode of this dumb podcast to hear about the creation in the early chapters of Genesis.
Yeah.
But the idea is that the earth is underwater.
Right.
And these kind of chaotic waters of creation. And God affects creation by creating this rakia, which literally it comes from a word that means to hammer out. And so you got to think of the steel drums playing while God kind of inserts this solid dome that separates the waters above from the waters beneath. So it is firm. It is a solid dome. And when you talk to conspiracy theorists today, they're like, yeah, there's no space travel. You just bounce off. So,
oh, let me tell you something. I had the delightful misfortune of I stopped on Google and went over to TikTok for some content about this. And man, the number of videos that I saw where it's like, they either we can't penetrate the firmament. If you look at all of the NASA, first of all, NASA is apparently a whole thing for these.
Oh, people. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a like this is a like they're talking about NASA means deception.
Deceive,
in
right.
In Hebrew, which does it?
No.
Okay.
No, it doesn't.
Are they referring to anything similar?
There's a verbal root nasha, and because this is usually written with diacritics, and they don't know how to read diacritics, they think N-A-S with a chevron on top of it, A, is pronounced NASA, but it's nasha. And then also, that's just a reconstructed verbal root. The word never actually appears as nasha. To mean deceive, it has to be used in the causative hifil stem. And so we get some morphological changes to it. You have to add a performative hey, you get an I quality vowel, you get a consonant cluster with the noon and the shin, which means the noon gets assimilated to the shin, and then you get an I quality vowel between the second and the third radical. And so basically wherever this word means deceive, it's being pronounced like in Genesis 3, where Eve says, the serpent beguiled me. And people are like, that means NASA. That word appears as Hishiani in that verse. So no relation whatsoever to NASA.
Cool.
Sorry to interrupt.
Not at all sorry I asked. But yeah,
the
so,
logo,
there, so there's
you've
a whole thing about
the serpent tongue in the logo.
So the NASA thing, they're talking about how like all the rockets actually curve and then just come down again. Nothing actually. And then there was all this stuff about SpaceX and how they're trying to like how one of their things actually hit the firmament, and they show a little thing, and it's obviously just like the separation of the stages or something
right,
like that.
Right.
But man, a lot of talk about firmament. There was even one, I saw one where it was like just an image of an observatory that happened to have like, I don't know, like looked like lasers shooting straight up. And it was like, are they trying to destroy the firmament?
It kind of gives you Mr. Burns vibes. For centuries, man has tried to blot out the sun.
and I'm going to do it. Yeah.
But it's, in the biblical conceptualization, there is a solid dome up there, and it's crystalline in nature and looks like sapphire, and that's why it's blue. Mm. And the windows of heaven are actual like holes that open up to let the rain fall. Mm. And then the heavens of the what's that?
I was gonna say the stars are like contained in the firmament.
Yes, yes. And they are, you know, they're moving around. In fact, I think if you look in, so this cosmology is kind of consistent in a bunch of different parts of ancient Southwest Asia, going back to the Bronze Age. The Hebrew Bible's representation is generally coming from the middle two quarters of the first millennium BCE. That's where we get most of the discussion.
Okay.
And then we get, but it's just these scattered references. We don't actually get an attempt to describe things until the Book of Enoch,
okay,
which is, as you can imagine, exciting. so the Book of Enoch is Hellenistic period. The majority of it's probably written between the third and the first century BCE. But you actually get a here's what the earth looks like, kind of pseudoscientific discussion. And I saw one part of it that was just so great. So the luminaries, the sun and the moon. And so this is 1st Enoch chapter 72. This is the first commandment of the luminaries. The sun is a luminary whose egress is an opening of heaven, which is located in the direction of the east, and whose ingress is another opening of heaven located in the west. I saw six openings through which the sun rises and six openings through which it sets. The moon also rises and sets through the same openings, and they are guided by the stars together with whom they lead. They are six in the east and six in the west heaven. All of them are arranged one after another in a constant order. So now we've got this idea of the stars and the luminaries kind of following specific tracks.
Yeah.
And
through openings.
Through openings, right. So it's like the open the window, the sun comes in. Hey everybody. And here I'm thinking of the alternate universe from Rick and Morty where the sun is just constantly screaming. I don't know if you've seen that episode, but it's great.
I don't think I've ever seen this Rich and Marty thing, but
you've never good. Seen Rick and Morty?
No, I saw like an episode or two. I didn't suck me in the way I was promised it would.
I think if you got into it, you would just love it. But yeah, okay. I can see how just one episode might you might not get hooked.
I like this Enoch description just because it reminds me of like you know, one of those big clocks in a German square that has all these things ticking around and like coming out of openings and going.
Some lady chasing a guy with a rolling pin around the outside. It's kind of like a Disneyland situation when the Pirates of the Caribbean.
It is a small world after all.
Yeah. Or a planetarium or something like that. But the idea is basically that this dry land exists within these within a ring of the sea. Mm-hmm. So basically you're surrounded by seas and you have references to the disc or the circle of the earth. And then the firmament comes up from the outside of the waters and then encloses this area and all the, you know, the birds of the skies and everything are in there. And then the luminaries and the planets and all of that. But Enoch actually talks about a little bit what's going on beyond the firmament when you go beyond the edges of the earth, getting a little Jules Verne on the Hellenistic Jewish world. And so I think there are a number of different drawings of the ancient Israelite concept of the cosmos, and who knows if any of them would actually match up with what an ancient Israelite or Judahite or early Jewish person might have drawn if you sat them down and were like, draw the cosmos. But generally, the idea is that you've got dry land surrounded by water. There's a firmament that comes up out of there that encloses that whole land. You've got an underworld, which is where the deceased are. And beneath that, you've got the pillars of the earth. And then this is all resting on the broader kind of primordial waters of creation / chaos / whatever. And there's also a concept that the gods inhabit the heavens above the heavens of the earth. And so from the way the Bible represents things, it's a flat earth.
Yeah.
It's obviously not what the earth is actually like.
Well, why wouldn't they have that representation? When no one could go more than, you know, literally if no one you know has ever traveled more than a couple hundred miles in their whole life, you know, it you're not going to be able to come up with a spherical idea. Like the earth is huge and looks flat from where you are, other than like bumps and mountains and things.
And most people, like, you know, you can see that far away, you can't really see things anymore, but they probably would have thought, oh, you just get smaller and smaller and smaller the further away you go, and you're just too small to see.
Yeah.
And you have references to there are a bunch of passages in the scriptures that make statements that suggest they imagine that they're on a pretty limited plot of land that is fairly flat. So, you know, the idea that every eye will see when Jesus comes in the clouds only makes sense if it's possible for every eye to see, because like everybody can see the sun,
right?
At least as far as we know, everybody can see the sun up in the sky.
It probably is at the same time. Like there's no way to, like, as you travel, there's no way to see that, you know, you're seeing the sun at a slightly different time than the place you came from or whatever.
Yeah. And you have in the Greek world, you have I think around the 5th century BCE, you start to have these ideas that the earth is round. Now, this is not based on scientific study. Initially, it's because Plato, I don't know if he got dumped or something, but he just got really into spheres and was just like, man, I love spheres. And so just hypothesized that all the perfect things, all the central main, all the main characters in the universe are spherical. And the idea is that every point is the exact same distance from the center. And ooh, doesn't that just make the tuning fork in your loins ring? Plato was a weird dude. But this information doesn't spread out to the Jewish world. But you have kind of the convergence of this aesthetic notion that the earth is round with developing notions based on like people who are taking measurements about shadows that are being cast in Egypt, right, and stuff like that from one part to, you know, a bunch of miles down the other direction. And as our ability to measure time and distances and things like that gets refined, it becomes more and more clear that we live on a spherical earth. And some of the earliest Christians insisted that we live on a spherical earth. Like there's an early Christian and philosopher named Athenagoras toward the end of the second century CE who is like, yep, the earth is straight up a sphere. And other people didn't buy it, but that became kind of the consensus view among the more philosophically oriented, the more thoughtful Christians.
Hey friends, it's heading into spring and summertime, which is one of my favorite times of year, but it's also a time when I want to be on the go, outside, living life, and not cooped up in my home making meals, and that's where Factor comes in. Factor is fresh, never frozen meals, dietitian approved, ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So whatever it is that you're doing for the summertime in these beautiful months, you'll be ready to go with Factor.
Every week they've got 35 different meals and they have more than 60 different add-ons to choose from. You've got breakfast, you've got dessert, you've got shakes, you've got smoothies. There's all kind of stuff to choose from. Just 2 minutes in the microwave for the entrees. It couldn't be any simpler. And I love the fact that I don't have to think about or worry about what I'm going to have for lunch most days if I've got Factor in the fridge.
Yeah, just a reminder that these are never frozen. So it is fresh food. It doesn't taste like what we think of when we think of a microwave meal. It is a different experience. And I encourage you to give it a try. And we're going to hook you up with 50% off. How do they do that, Dan?
So head to factormeals.com/dogma50 and use code dogma50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. So that's code dogma50 at factormeals.com/dogma50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active.
What's something you learned in history class that you feel wasn't the whole truth? Better yet, what's something you didn't learn at all that was omitted completely? That's what I like to call redacted history. I believe that all history, no matter how good or bad, needs to be told. There are wars, massacres, battles, and entire historical events that are just not in our school's history books. Have you ever heard of Mary Bowser? I didn't think so. My name is Andre White, the host of the Redacted History Podcast, the place where history's forgotten events, heroes, and villains get their story told, one episode at a time. So come huddle around the campfire with me and get ready to hear the stories that you were robbed of. And get comfortable. We're going to be here a while. The Redacted History Podcast. Real history never dies. Stream the Redacted History Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of a spherical Earth dates back to ancient Greece. Like, this is not something that was not around. The people who you know, were alive in biblical times, or at least late biblical times, they might have encountered this idea.
I imagine they did, but we just don't see it reflected in any of the texts. So folks, right, like, you know, the author of the Gospel of John or Paul, maybe they believed in a spherical earth. they never say one way or another.
Right.
And some people talk about this idea that there are the four corners of the earth.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, that means it's got to be a flat earth. And it's like, I talk about the corners of the earth, the ends of the earth, the edge of the earth. That doesn't mean that I think there are actually four points that sit at the four corners of a square or something. It's a figure of speech.
It is very funny to me how many people, how often I will hear someone say, when they're defending their take on the Bible, one thing is obviously literal, and another thing is obviously a metaphor or figurative.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, if one thing can be figurative, other things can also be figurative, and how do you know the difference?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of rhetoric where we're just kind of doing our best to try and feel it out and try to figure out, does this make more sense as figurative? What's the trend when we see this language being used? Are there any contexts in which it is more clear if it's one or the other? But yeah, I don't think the whole corners of the earth idea is very determinative, but we do see people talking about that. One thing I did want to bring up is there's a word in Hebrew, chug, that is chet vav gimel. And this word occurs in a handful of places, but Isaiah 40, verse 22, is a place that people will bring up a lot. And this, let's see, the NRSVUE says this: it is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to live in. And this, and people will appeal to this as evidence that the Bible is already aware that the earth is a sphere, because they hear circle. And then Job, I think there's some stuff in, Job 22:14. The KJV says he walketh in the circuit of heaven.
Huh.
NET says vault of heaven. NRSVUE says dome of heaven. So I guess they're trying to link this word chug with the firmament, the dome. But chug is like you draw a chug with a compass. So circle, disc, it's not necessarily a sphere. It's just a circle. And so Isaiah 40, verse 22, is talking about this idea of the disk of the earth that's surrounded by water.
Okay.
And it is not talking about the globe of the earth. Proverbs 8:27, the famous creation of wisdom, has a part where it says, when he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. And this idea being, we're inscribing the boundaries of the deep, and the dry land is going to be within those boundaries. So it's a circle. It's not a sphere. So folks who appeal to that as evidence that that Isaiah already knows about a spherical earth doesn't work all that well.
Yeah, I mean, and I think, when I look at biblical references and I see references like ends of the earth or corners of the earth, I don't see anyone. Yeah, it doesn't seem to me like anyone's trying to make a solid representation of what the earth is.
Yeah,
they're just it mostly seems to me to be either figurative language or just sort of a big
another one that comes up quite a bit is Job 26:7. And let me pull this up and see what the NRSV has to say about this. So he stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth upon nothing. And so people will say, that indicates God knows that the earth is floating in space and that it is not on foundations, that it is not resting in a sea of primordial goo.
What about the pillars then? And what's it hanging
always,
on?
You always bring it back to the pillars. No, and this is where Job is getting particularly poetic. He binds up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not torn open by them. He covers the face of the full moon and spreads over it his cloud. He has described a circle in the face of the waters. That's probably inscribed. Yeah, yeah. He at the boundary between light and darkness, the pillars of heaven tremble and are astounded at his rebuke. So yeah, now yeah, heaven has pillars,
yeah.
And they get scared when God gives them a talking to. So this is very, very figurative language. But for some people, it's a proof text. If they want to try to suggest that as a scientific document, the Bible is accurate in all that it claims about the natural world, then they need something in there, even if it means you got to reject the other 999 things that are pretty clearly a flat earth perspective and say, well, we got this one.
Yeah. I guess I just, you know, it was so funny when the flat earth theory started to regain prominence sort of 10 or 15 years ago, or it started to come back into sort of the parlance of our time. It took me by surprise. I was shocked.
Yeah. Yeah.
When it started to happen. And I could not for the life of me figure out why it was happening. Like, we had literally thousands of years of knowledge all pointing to a spherical earth. It was set. It was done. It was easy. And then I was like, why is this happening? And I think that it, you know, Genesis is a problem. I think that a lot of it started from people not wanting that firmament model of an earth with a dome over it to be refuted in their Bible. I think I don't think that's the whole of the thing. I don't think that's all of why people. I think there's a lot of people that just really want to reject, you know, sort of understood knowledge.
Yeah,
because that's part of their personality. They you know, skepticism is good, but badly applied skepticism is bad. And I think,
yeah,
and
I think there are a lot of people who there's an awful lot of pushback. And so you can revise your position, or you can dig in your heels. And we've got an awful lot of that going on, where people are just digging in their heels and saying, no, I'm drawing a line here. And I don't care if it's just bafflingly dumb. I'm going to dig in my heels because this is an identity marker now.
Yeah.
And so to show everybody I'm a real one, that I'm one of the good ones, I'm going to dig in my heels and make ridiculous claims in public just to put on display just how mindless I'm willing to be.
I don't know. I'm going to push back on you because I've seen a lot of actually smart people making really interesting and scientifically literate arguments about why this could be true. And in the end, it doesn't hold up. But they're using real math. They're using real, you know, real ideas and concepts that dumb people wouldn't come up with.
Well, they're performing that, because when you try to take real math and real science and take all of it,
yeah,
then it obviously doesn't make any sense. I think those arguments are always isolating a tiny little sliver of real math and real science to say, if we look at this little part right here, then that can be made to fit if you squint hard enough at it. Yeah. And therefore, the whole rest of the scientific community can just be summarily dismissed.
Yeah, and
it always seems to come down to that, whether it's climate change or whether it's the global flood or whether it's around Earth. I love the last couple of times we've had these eclipses, or there's been a lunar eclipse. I love the folks who show the image of the moon, and then there's like a little tiny disc shaped shadow passing over the moon. It's like, shouldn't we be seeing this?
Yeah. Like a slit as opposed to a circle or whatever.
And depending on which part of the earth you're on, maybe it's a little more oblong, but it's it's never approaching a perfect circle.
Yeah, it is funny. And then, you know, I will say that the people who are genuinely smart and they focus in on some of these scientific questions and mathematical questions in terms of the shape of the earth, you can generally find them like going all the way with their experimentation or with their math, and then eventually going, oh wait, that didn't work out the way it should have.
Yeah,
hang on and stuff. So anyway,
there've been some people who have converted to reality.
Yeah,
and have been high profile about it. Have gone out and say I no longer believe this, and you know they've had big time followings on YouTube and elsewhere in social media, and have and have seen the light, and then have come back to try to evangelize their compatriots, and it doesn't go well for them.
At least
with their old community.
Once you've converted people to something like that, it's hard to get them to let go of it.
Yeah.
However, smart people, good people, people who are of good faith and wish only to be seeking better and more up-to-date knowledge do often revise their positions, their older positions.
Yes, they do.
Which I think is a good segue into our opportunities for growth. So, tell us, Dan, you know, we teased it at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You had a position that was, that you took on our show and elsewhere, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you ended up butting up against some people. Talk us through it. Tell us what you had originally said. And then, and then what arguments have been made that steered you in a slightly different direction.
Well, like 9 or 10 weeks ago, we did an episode of the show where one of the things we talked about was Matthew's description of the triumphal entry and Jesus riding into Jerusalem on two animals at the same time.
Yes.
And it was a laugh riot.
We had a good time.
We had a good time. And I had made a video about that probably 2 or 3 weeks prior to that. The way I had interpreted the text is we have this text where it says Jesus tells them, hey, go get me, go to this house, you'll find a donkey and you will find a colt tied up with it. Untie him, bring him to me. If the owner gives you any guff, just give him a swift backhand. tell him the Lord has need of them and they'll let you go. And it says they brought the donkey and the colt to Jesus, and this was done so that the prophecy in Zechariah 9:9 would be fulfilled. And they took their cloaks and they put them on them, and they put him on them. And initially I was pointing out the distinction between the King James rendering, which I was suggesting obscures this by saying they sat him thereon, which is not marked for number.
Right.
But the them is very clearly plural. And whether you understand the antecedent of that pronoun to be the them that is the animals or the them that is the cloaks that are on the animals, the way the text is telling the story, Jesus is sitting on top of two animals.
Right.
And we
went through a bunch of different good ways to visualize this.
Yes, yes.
Including the sofa and ottoman style, the human donkey pyramid where you've got a donkey, a little donkey, and then a person up on top.
Right. There are a bunch of different ways that it has been visualized historically. And as I pointed out, we even have like medieval artwork from Christians who are representing Jesus sitting on the larger donkey with his feet resting on the colt that is tied up. Or some people say he switched back and forth. And after I made my initial video and then we released the podcast episode, there was some debate online on places like YouTube and elsewhere where apologists were bringing up challenges to this. And most of it had to do with how we think Matthew was interpreting the prophecy, whether it was a misunderstanding or whether he was intentionally interpreting it a certain way and presenting the fulfillment of a prophecy in a very careful, very specific way. And I think in our episode, I even said, whether or not you think that Matthew misunderstood this, but I suggested that Matthew was representing Jesus as riding on two animals because they were so concerned with ensuring that Jesus is fulfilling this prophecy to the T. And the prophecy, as Matthew is representing it, comes through, it's a Greek translation. It's not exactly what the Septuagint says, but it's close to it. And I suggested that the apposition of the original prophecy, so the original prophecy in Hebrew says, he will come riding on a donkey, even a colt, the foal of a donkey. And this is apposition. This is right. This is just saying the same thing two different ways.
Right.
So there's one animal in view, I think the Hebrew says the foal of Jenny's or something like that. And in the Greek translation, however, it just seems to be two animals. He will come riding on a donkey and a colt, the foal of a donkey or Jenny's or something like that. And I suggested that Matthew is just trying to fulfill the prophecy exactly as they found in the Greek translation.
Right.
And listening to the discussion, watching people argue about this, I think that there's a better way to understand it. I think that Matthew is actually trying to eat his cake and have it too. I think that Matthew is, because there is ambiguity regarding the on them pronoun. Does this refer to the clothing? Does it refer to the animals? And so naturally, like if somebody told you this story and you'd never heard any of this before, you would be like, wait, is he sitting on both animals? Because it's just not clear. You would want clarification and the story does not clarify.
Right.
So if Matthew sees the prophecy as saying two animals, it seems to me he's telling the story in a way that plausibly could be said to fulfill this prophecy with two animals, and yet also plausibly could be interpreted as only as him having only one mount, him riding on only one animal. So the idea is, hey, Matthew, are there two animals or one? Precisely.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, and Matthew, so, are there two animals or one? Oh, look over there.
When Johann Rahl received the letter on Christmas Day 1776, he put it away to read later. Maybe he thought it was a season's greeting and wanted to save it for the fireside. But what it actually was a warning, delivered to the Hessian colonel, letting him know that General George Washington was crossing the Delaware and would soon attack his forces. The next day, when Rahl lost the Battle of Trenton and died from two Colonial Boxing Day musket balls, the letter was found, unopened, in his vest pocket. As someone with 15,000 unread emails in his inbox, I feel like there's a lesson there. Oh well, this is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Every episode, we look at the bad ideas, mistakes, and accidents that misshaped our world. Find us at constantpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, if I understand the new take is that it's not Matthew specifically saying Jesus is riding on these two animals. It is Matthew being purposefully obtuse so that you could take either position and it would be justifiable with his language.
I think that makes more sense to me now. Okay. In light of the arguments I've seen. And there are other arguments out there. There's a scholar named Carlson who published two papers in, I think, Catholic Biblical Quarterly like 5 years ago, arguing that that the way Matthew describes the prophecy is the plenary fulfillment of Zechariah 9:9, where he's trying to include all of the imagery, all of the possible imagery that comes from Zechariah. And it's a complex argument for why the "on them" means that Jesus was actually on the colt. I think reasonable people can disagree about this. There have been numerous different ways to try to explain what's going on here. The more I think about it, the more I consider the other arguments. I don't think there's a way to say the text indicates Jesus is only riding on one animal. I don't think the two mount reading is precluded by anything. I think that has to be a possibility, but it makes more sense to me now that the ambiguity there has a rhetorical role in the way that Matthew has crafted this. Because, you know, if Matthew shows this draft to somebody, hey, look what I'm working on. They're going to be like, I think you may need to make it a little more clear what's going on here. And he's like, right. Ah, that's the point. that makes the most sense to me. And so this is the judgment that I am a little more comfortable with now. That's not to say that, you know, this is the way it has to be and everybody is wrong. This is not the consensus view.
This is the official position of the Data Over Dogma podcast, and all of its listeners have to now assume,
and all of its subsidiaries and affiliates. And
that's right. Everyone now from now on has to
in
believe
perpetuity
this way until further revised by you, because we are all your acolytes and have to believe as you do.
Which is a horrific thing to think about, and I'm glad it will never be the case.
Well, I mean, it's kind of the point of having this segment, right? Is the idea that, like, just to demonstrate that this is all we're doing the best we can. Like, scholarship in general as a concept is, especially scholarship like this, where it's about something that was written 2000 plus years ago.
Yeah.
You know, two or more. And all we have is best guesses. And all we have, and it's important to revise those ideas as other people's arguments come into play.
Yeah. I agree. I think that, you know, this is not a quote unquote hard science. It's a real squishy science. For the most part, what we're doing is we're taking a bunch of judgment calls and we're just trying to see which judgment calls make the most sense, have the most support. And that's kind of our moving target. This is where we are right now. And everybody changes on these things. A paper I published in 2018 in the Journal of Biblical Literature on Psalm 82, where I argued that Psalm 82 is a post-exilic, very late composition. If you had told me 10 years before that I was going to be arguing that Psalm 82 was post-exilic, I would have laughed in your face, because I was with the majority of scholars who saw Psalm 82 as one of the oldest texts in the Hebrew Bible, one of the earliest passages that sees Adonai and El as separate deities, that is a divine council scene, that is just this archaic mythology. And the more I looked at it, and the more I looked at it, and the more I tried to figure out what was going on here, I slowly changed my mind till I got to the point that I was like, no, I am convinced that it is the other way around. And so if you want to go see the argument that I've made, you can find my article on my Linktree. It's called The God's Complaint, plural God's Complaint. Psalm 82 is a psalm of complaint. And that's an example. People ask me from time to time, what are some things you've changed your mind about? That's an example. I think the Matthew writing, the triumphal entry question is another. There have been these things. And as we talked with David Carr last week, and even he said that 1996 David Carr doesn't always agree with 2024 David Carr. And this is just the nature of the beast. And so,
well, and it's the mark of a honest scholar or an honest person to say, like, I don't trust someone who agrees with their, you know, with 15 years ago them about everything. That's not you. You haven't done any work in that time period. If that's how you are,
and I think that's. I think that that's one of the indications of someone who is not committed to a series of dogmas, because there are a lot of folks who they have some wiggle room, but there are walls.
Yeah,
and they are not going to go over those walls, not for anything whatsoever. And there are folks who, you know, they may be convinced of stuff to differing degrees, but for the most part, anything's fair game. And I'd like to think that I'm in that position that. I have tried to model that where I'm not committed to anything to the degree that I just will say, no, it's impossible that it is this other thing within reason. You know, the flat earth, I think, is something that's, you know, that's not the kind of thing we're talking about.
It was funny because you were talking about the walls that people have set up and they're sort of dogmatic walls.
Yeah.
And the image that instantly popped into my mind.
The ice
is
wall.
The ice wall.
Yeah.
That the flat earthers think surrounds the disc of the earth.
It would be fun to see if there were any flat earthers who were talking about this ice wall before. Game of Thrones.
Hey man, that thing looks pretty good.
Yeah, I kind of like this idea. Yeah, but in terms of actual like legitimate scholarly theories, I think everything has to be potentially on the table, and that's one of the things that frustrates me with a lot of the content that I engage with is there's only half a table there. And they're only going to play with whatever is on half of that table.
Yeah.
But yeah, so not a huge change, but.
No, it seems pretty minor when it comes down to it.
Well, I hesitated to, like, when I was decided to make this video this morning for my social media accounts, the socials, it took me, I was like contemplating, do I really want to do this? I'm opening myself up for criticism, even though it's a pretty minor thing. But that's one of the things that bothers me, and that's one of the things that can disincentivize more open, honest engagement. I would be lying if I said that I just go full bore whatever I'm thinking without ever considering the implications or the consequences. That's just not true. Right. I do think about that stuff, and I would like to think that it does not. I am not self-censoring because of that. So I was like, no, if I feel this way, I've got to go through with this just because I wouldn't be able to look at myself in the mirror. Oh no, they're going to make fun of me.
Well, let them. I mean, the truth is that like the people who would make fun of someone for revising their position based on new or different information are the people that like, they're really telling on themselves about what's important to them and what they value, which isn't truth, certainly. It may be something like, you know, people value their dogmatic beliefs and whatever, but it would be pretty hypocritical of you to have a dogmatic view that is impermeable to data, considering the title of our show.
Yeah, I'm trying to live up. A lot of people are like, "There's no, you can't be data over dogma," and I'm like, "Look, from day one, I have said this is aspirational.
Yeah,
nobody can do this perfectly. It is aspirational, and so I'm trying to live up to the standards to which we aspire on the Data Over Dogma podcast, and that's why I thought, hey, maybe this would be a good segment to talk about. It's a little shift, but it's an example of me owning up to having changed my perspective.
Yeah.
And
it's funny, I made fun of it for being little, but as you point out, like entire careers are made on tiny little like this is a field of study that concerns itself with minutiae. So yeah. I think I should be more open to little things.
It's the little things.
It's the little things.
Like the great poet once said, it's the little people like you, Clark, and your family. That's Christmas Vacation.
Yes, just indeed. In case.
One of the greatest films ever made. In my humble opinion.
That Griswold family is a real hoot. Beverly D'Angelo, you know, lots of young crushes, I'll just say.
okay. We didn't need to go there, but all right, that's fair.
She came up. All right. Well, listen, you and I are going to continue our conversation in a much less formal way over on the Patreon. So if any of you friends out there would like to help be a part of making this show go and get extra added bonus content and an early ad-free version of every episode of the show, you can become a patron too. Just go head over to patreon.com/dataoverdogma if you'd like to do that. You can reach us by writing into contact@dataoverdogmapod.com. Other than that, we'll just see y'all again next week.
Bye, everybody.
Data Over Dogma is a member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. It is a production of Data Over Dogma Media, LLC, copyright 2023, all rights reserved.